Welcome to Wade for Wireless. This is my podcast, my blog cast, because I have a blog that goes along with it. And I want to introduce Bruce L. Hi, Bruce.
How are you doing?
And he was a victim of RF radiation, I guess you'd say poisoning, at a broadcast site when he worked as a climber. The accident happened while he was on a broadcast tower, changing out a light, a beacon. So, and we'll go into that. We'll go into the story. But, hey, Bruce, how long were you a climber? How many years?
On and off, almost 10.
10 years. You started in, the late 80s?
Actually, I started early 90s.
Early 90s? I don't remember. How many companies did you work for? Did you work for one for a long time, or did you jump around?
I jumped around. I moved around the country, and I found that it didn't matter where I went in the country. There was always a tower company willing to grab an experienced climber.
Yeah, that's true. And we talked earlier, just so everyone knows, but yeah, we talked about climbing back when you just wore your telephone pole belts. That's what I call them, a lineman's belt, when it just had the D-rings on each side.
Yeah. Actually, a lot of us guys who weren't comfortable with just a D-ring, we would wrap lanyards from D-ring to D-ring and kind of make a sitting harness out of lanyards, and then we would have a spare set of lanyards to tie on with.
Yeah, that way you had something to sit on, right?
Yep.
So did you work mostly in broadcast? Did you do wireless, cell phones, paging, all the other industries?
I did them all.
Yeah, I think that's what every climber says after they've been in the business for a while. So I think it's a little different now. I think you see people now that they either work exclusively on cell, because there's so much work for the carriers out there, where they do broadcast and the carriers.
Well, when I was in, it was, cell companies, there weren't that many, and if you weren't doing cell, you were doing maintenance for the government, you were doing 911 systems. Your main carriers were like AT&T and Nextel.
Yeah. Nextel had a lot of work. I do remember that. I remember AT&T did, but Nextel, because I did a lot of work for Nextel. I mean, it just had, it was just so much work at the time.
Well, they were the first ones to come out with the telephone with the radio, the radio built in. So
yeah,
that was the newest thing. And I mean, everybody was jumping on that bandwagon, and their broadcast went crazy.
Isn't it amazing they're gone now? Nextel's gone. I mean, it's part of Sprint, but, the whole concept, iGen, that's just history now.
Yeah.
So, sorry, didn't mean to get off on a tangent. So, what we're here to talk about, I wanted to talk about, I wrote a blog about the radiation poisoning that Bruce had. I call radiation poisoning. I guess you got fried in the tower. That's what happened.
That's what they call it. They actually call it radiation poisoning.
Okay, so that was the official term then.
Yeah.
So, I'm not exactly going to go back. How long ago was it? How many years?
Oh, God. It was 95.
Oh, back in 95. So, the day it happened, I mean, you've been climbing a while now. You had a lot of years under your belt. So the day it happened, I mean, it's just a normal climb. You're going up to replace a beacon, and you went up the tower by yourself?
Yep.
You had a ground crew, a couple guys on the ground, or at least one guy?
One guy on the ground.
So when you went up, you talked to the station engineer before you went up, and he was supposed to turn the power back, right?
Yeah, actually, the guy on the ground, the foreman on the ground went in and made sure everything was secured and done the way it was supposed to, and they sent me up to change the strobe light.
Okay. So everything was done right. So when you got your radiation poisoning, was it on low power, or did someone turn it up high? What happened?
Well, from what I was told, it was dropped down to 10%. Because back in the in that era, that was like the safe thing. That was 10% output power was safe. I mean, they didn't really have any figures on what really was safe, so the you know the going guidelines was 10%.
And back then, just so everyone knows, there were no RF meters, no NARDA alerts, nothing like that, right?
No. It was you and your belt and your harness, and that's it.
Yep, whatever tool you could muster to carry up.
Yep. Yeah, you didn't have anything, no patches, no monitors, nothing. I mean, it was just climbing.
So you're up there working. Did you feel the heat? And I mean that literally. I mean, did you feel hot? You said it. Was it a cold day? And did you get hot? What was it like up there?
I can tell you exactly what it was. It was February 17th, 1995 in upstate New York. I mean, way upstate New York. It was snow on the ground. There's 3 feet of snow on the ground.
Wow. How were you feeling on the top? Were you getting sick? Were you just hot?
I mean, at the time, I thought I was sweating from the climb, but even after I was sitting still, I was sweating. I mean, I could feel the heat while I was up there. I thought I was just sweating to death.
But you didn't know what it was, right? You were just up there.
I had no clue.
Wow. So you just felt hot, and you figured, you know, you're bundled up. You just climbed however many feet. How high up were you?
550 feet.
550 feet, yeah. Just feeling hot, man. You figure I climbed up, I'm bundled up. Was the wind blowing or wasn't blowing? I'm just curious.
Yeah, anything above 500 feet, the wind's blowing.
Yeah, so, man. So how close were you to the antenna?
I was sitting on it.
Oh, okay. So you're literally sitting on it.
Well, it's a 500-foot tower, and the top 50 feet, it's 550 feet tall, and from 500 to 550, it's basically a broadcast pylon.
Yeah.
And then the beacon's actually bolted to the top of the pylon.
So... younger guys, so they can picture this, anyone who's never worked on broadcast antennas back in the day were huge, and they put them on top of the towers, and they actually had climbing pegs on it. I assume this had climbing pegs on, right?
Actually, it had bat wings.
Oh, it had bat wings on it. So that's how you got up it.
Yep.
And they put the beacons, just to describe it to everybody, they put the beacons up on top of the antenna. So... And the reason for that was FAA. They had to put a beacon on the highest point in the tower. So you had to do anything to the beacon, you literally had to climb up the antenna, which was a huge steel structure. I mean, it wasn't like, for all you guys that just do cellular work, it wasn't like a cellular antenna. It wasn't like a panel. It was a huge steel structure. I mean, is that right, Bruce? I mean, it was big, heavy, and massive for the most part.
Yeah, well, the actual center part of the pylon is about 18 inches wide, and then the bat wings stretched off either side, and the bat wings are usually about 15 inches wide. I mean, so you're looking at a pretty good sized structure on both sides. You just climbed up it like it was a big ladder.
Yep. So just so everyone can picture that, because I think a lot of guys that just do carrier work don't understand that broadcast was a different world. But, it's just trying to point out, you know, you had to climb up the antenna. So when you do carrier work, any type of wireless carrier, you're right by the antennas, so it's a similar effect. Hey, at 10%, how much power do you think the transmitter was putting out?
The transmitter was a 350 kilowatt. So even at 10%, it was 35,000 watts.
Good Lord. Still high power. Plus, the antenna was probably a high-gain antenna.
Yeah.
Probably another 10 dB on top of that. Dude. That's freaking unreal. So, let me see. So, you're sitting up there. You're working. How long were you up there?
About 45 minutes.
45 minutes. So you're up, replace the beacon, and then you headed down the tower, right?
Yeah.
Did you feel anything right away? I mean, other than being hot, did you feel sick? Did you feel discomfort?
Nope.
Nothing at all.
I felt towered, tired. I felt drained. But I mean, when you're young and you don't really know anything, I mean, you're just thinking, I must have tired my ass out climbing up and down a tower. I mean, you start from where we pick up, get into the truck and go up there and do all the work and then come home. I mean, you climb one tower, you get back, it's time to go home. I mean, you're looking at like a hour and a half, almost 2 hour ride one way. You get back, it's time to go home. So I was tired. I just felt like I wore myself out. But I didn't show after effects of what was really going on until I got home. And I still didn't even know what was going on then. But I got real sick that night. My roommate and my girlfriend at the time, I thought I was going to die. I almost passed out. I couldn't regulate my body temp. I ended up in basically an ice cold bath trying to drop my body temp.
Oh man, did you go to the hospital that night or the doctor or anything?
No, I ended up basically laying in a freezing cold tub for a good half hour, 45 minutes, and then my body temp came down, but I went right to bed.
Yeah. Whew. Man. So you were sick that night, like you had fever. Were you nauseous? Did you feel like you were going to throw up? Did you have headaches?
Well, I was real sick. I had a fever that wouldn't break. But yeah. It wasn't like when you get the flu and then you get a fever. It was just this ungodly high temperature that just wouldn't break. It's hard to describe how I felt. I remember my body temp being just, it was almost like you're about to throw up and you've got this horrible flu and stomach ache and everything hits you all at the same time. It was like my body temperature skyrocketed and nobody knew why. It wasn't like I had the flu. And then you spend a half hour, 45 minutes in a cold tub, everything breaks and goes away. And then it was right on to the next day, like nothing had happened.
So you got up the next morning, you didn't feel sick or anything?
Nope.
Oh, wow. That's wild. So your fever that night, you feel like crap. You're in the tub, you take the ice bath for a half hour, fever breaks, you go to bed sort of feeling like crap, and then you get up the next morning, I mean, you probably still feel a little bad, but you're feeling a lot better than you did the night before. So,
yeah, and I went right back to work.
Gee almighty. So when did things get worse for you?
About 3 or 4 months later is when the migraine started. And, it had progressively started with just headaches. But, I mean, back in the day I was a drinker, so... I mean, going out to the bar and getting plastered and, waking up with a hangover, you're used to headaches. So you're just thinking your headaches are, quit drinking so much. But
yeah,
these progressively got worse. And by about February of 96, the migraines had hit me full force. And they were bad. I mean... debilitating bad, put you in a dark room, puking, everything would aggravate it. It didn't matter what it was, whether it was light, sounds, voices, you name it, it would throw you into a hysterical, painful migraines.
Wow. So were you going to the doctor at this time, figure out what it was?
No, I was just... At that time, I was young, and I was worried only about money. I wasn't worried about my health. I was worried about my paycheck.
Yeah. So no doctor, and did you have insurance, or you didn't have insurance?
No, I didn't have insurance either. I moved around a lot, so I didn't even have insurance.
Wow. Were you able to work with these migraines? I mean, how'd that go?
No, I worked with them. Most of my employers that I've had, you know, for the longest time, I tell them before I start, look, if I have a migraine and I got to stop, you have to either deal with it or you don't hire me. And most of the employers were more than willing to accept the fact that I have migraines because, you've got a communications guy with experience. They'll deal with it.
Yeah, I remember. Back in the day, that was a big deal. Someone who knew what they were. Experience counted for a lot. So when you got, like, how often did you get these migraines? Were you getting them all the time? Were you getting them once a week?
In the beginning, I would get one bad one, probably about a week, one bad one a week. At my worst, when my health finally got to the point where I just couldn't climb anymore, I was getting probably 3 to 4 nasty migraines a week.
Wow.
And when I say nasty, I mean a trip to the ER and being put on a morphine trip.
Really?
Yeah.
So describe what happened. Like you would get these migraines. Would they just hit you like all at once, or did you feel it coming on? Did you have any warning?
I feel them coming on. I still get them now, but they're nowhere near as debilitating as they were. I mean, they're still painful, and every once in a while I'll get one that really hits me like a Mack truck. But some of the worst ones, I would feel them coming on, and you either take the anti-migraine meds, or if you can't catch them fast enough, I mean, they hit you. And when they hit you, the ones that I get are behind my eyeballs. So anything, any source of light at all is horrible.
Oh,
and
wow.
then you're throwing up. And then once you're into the throwing up phase, it's all over. I mean, it's hot shower, hot washcloth, anything you can do to try and break the migraine. I mean, they're bad.
So,
but I've had migraines that I get them where if you don't catch them in time and they rebound, and they come back with a vengeance almost. And I've had ones that rebound for anywhere from 2 to 7 days.
Oh man. And you just have to live with this, basically. You try to take your medicine ahead of time, but if you don't catch it, you're screwed.
Well, if you don't catch it in time, the medicine just kicks it backwards and then rebounds it. You'll get it back, you know, six hours later, it'll hit you full force again.
Okay. Oh, dude. Couldn't imagine that.
It's painful.
So painful, yeah. So at what point, so you went to the emergency room a couple times, at what point did you call a doctor and start setting up doctor appointments to see what's wrong with you?
I started getting MRIs and stuff like that done in the late 90s. I had a doctor at Johns Hopkins who started looking at MRI readings and seeing things that weren't normal. Swelling of the optic nerve, which it's hard to get swelling of the optic nerve unless you have some kind of disease that attacks the optic nerve or, you know, something. But for somebody who never did anything to his eyes, I mean, I had perfect vision. I never did anything to my eyes, damaged them. I never, you know, never had a head injury, none of that. And yet I had swelling in the optic nerve, and he couldn't figure that out. And it wasn't until I started putting two and two together and saying, look, I was on a radio tower that was reduced to, you know, to 10%. And then when information started trickling back and forth, that's when this guy said, look, there's a good chance that what you dealt with radiation exposure wise could have done massive amounts of damage to the optic nerve. That's when I started thinking, look, it was right after I was on that tower that I started getting migraine headaches.
Wow. So did you stick with the same doctor for a long time, or did you have to see a lot of different doctors?
I've seen doctors from all over the country. I moved around a lot.
Yeah.
But from Johns Hopkins to, I lived here in upstate, on and off, all over upstate New York, and I spent a little over a year going to a couple of different doctors in Cooperstown at Bassett, and they were neurologists that put me through, oh God, EMGs, which are really not so fun. I went through MRIs and CAT scans. I mean, they've been trying to figure out what's going on, but there's a lot of doctors who just don't know about radiation. I mean, you tell them I was exposed to radiation, and they look at you like you just grew a third arm.
Yeah. Is it still that way today, you think?
No, it isn't, because there are so many people that are, I mean, you do a Google search and you'll find people that are, you know, they have a tumor in their ear from using their cell phone.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's a little more prevalent where, you know, back in the 90s, the only time you could get radiation was doing, well, what we do. I mean, you've got military guys that were getting radiation poisoning from working around the radar installations and stuff like that, but for the most part, the only guys that were getting exposed to radiation were the guys climbing towers.
Yeah. So, yeah, all these problems, you had no insurance, which is just awful. So you had such pain, you'd go to the hospital and you had to deal with it. And then I guess if you tried to get different jobs, no insurance company would pick you up because of a pre-existing condition. Is that right?
No, that's exactly right.
So that's got to be rough. That just sucks.
It sucked because I mean, to be honest, the tower climbing industry is good money. So you're a young guy like I was back then, and you know you're banking all these thousands of dollars that you're making because, well, God, if you're smart, you can make more than you can spend.
Yeah.
So then you save up your savings, and then when you get sick like I did, well, you spend it all in the hospital.
Yeah. When you'd go to the hospital, were you usually there for a few hours, a few days, or what was the story there?
A few hours. Usually for a nasty migraine, I would go in. I was already in the hospital records because I was constantly going for the migraines. And they would bring up the records, and they would they'd basically give me one injection to stop me from throwing up, and then they'd give me morphine. And 15, 20 minutes later, the morphine would kick in, the migraine would go away, and, well, they'd basically send me packing. But, I mean, every time you go to the hospital and you get an injection, I mean, you're talking hundreds, if not $1,000 to, you know, break a migraine.
Yeah, man, that'd be rough. So you go to the hospital, they give you morphine. How'd you get to in front of the hospital? Someone take you? I'm just trying to picture that. I mean, there you are all pumped.
Oh, no. No, there was a couple of times I drove my own ass home pumped full of morphine.
Can you imagine driving there with a migraine and driving home full of morphine?
Yeah, and you don't even know which is worse, the driving with the migraine or driving while pumped full of morphine.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. God bless you, Bruce. I mean, geez, oh my, you just can't freaking imagine that. You really, I mean, that had to be rough. That had to be a rough time in your life, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of the rougher times. You have to do what you have to do. And, I mean, if the only thing that's going to break the migraine is the morphine, well, I'm more than willing to drive with a migraine to get rid of that migraine.
Yeah, I'm with you. So, we talked migraines. You and I talked earlier. Let's talk, what other side effects did you have?
I've got horrible nerve damage. I can't feel anything below my knees. I can't feel anything below my elbows.
Now, explain that. When people say you can't feel anything, tell them, like, if you cut yourself, do you feel that?
No, I don't feel that. If I cut myself, I don't know I've done it until I see blood. So if I'm working in an area, I'm working with my hands, and I'm not looking at my hands. If I cut myself, I start bleeding all over the place, and I don't know it until I see blood all over the place.
Wow. So you don't feel cuts, you don't feel scrapes, nothing like that?
I don't feel cold. I don't feel heat. I can actually stick my hands in, you know, the hottest possible water that will come out of the tap to wash dishes, and I don't know that it's too hot until I see my hands turn red.
What if I got a dumb question? What if you hit your finger with a hammer or something? I mean, smash it. Not that you do that, but you know, accidents happen. You feel anything like that?
No. I've actually hammered the top of my hand with a 3-pound sledge when I was trying to use a cold chisel, and I missed the cold chisel. And it smashed the living hell out of the top of my hand. The swelling and everything, but I didn't know I hit my hand.
Ugh. Wow. No throbbing, no pain, no nothing?
No, nothing. Now, if I hurt myself hard enough for it to radiate to an area of my body that does have nerves, then I know it. It's almost like the other nerves will double the amount of pain that I'm feeling in order for me to notice that I've been hit.
Wow. Man, I can't even imagine that. That's insane. I mean, geez. So how long after you got radiated till the nerve damage in your arms and, your hands and feet, your arms and legs? How many years?
Well, I knew about the numbness not very long after the exposure, but my family has got prevalent arthritis.
Okay.
So I just thought that arthritis was setting in like it did with my father, because he started getting arthritis in his hands and arms back in his mid-30s. So I just thought I was getting an early dosage of the same arthritis that my father suffered from.
Arthritis, though, that's in the joints, right?
Yeah, and my father has it really bad in his hands and his elbows.
Okay, so you just figured it was in the joints and you were getting stiff from arthritis. But then you found out you were numb. You were numb in your feet and hands. Oh, my God. So you were numb in your feet and hands, and you can't feel anything. That just must have been a strange feeling. What kind of problems do you have from that? I mean,
well, it actually becomes a very large pain because, I could get into a vehicle, and if I had to drive for, let's say, more than 20 minutes, my legs would go to sleep. My whole legs would start to tingle, and then when I tried to get out of the truck, I damn near fall onto my face.
Yeah. So they went to sleep that quick. Well, what else happened? I mean, what else did you notice from this, from the numbness?
Besides the numbness?
Yeah.
It destroyed the ability for me to have kids. That was a big one for me. And it actually degraded the enamel in my teeth.
Did you lose your teeth, or did they chip? Crack?
They're all gone.
Oof, they're all gone.
I lost my first tooth. I mean, I'm not talking about my child teeth. I'm not talking about some dude punched me in the mouth. I'm talking about eating normal food at the dinner table and breaking a tooth off at the gum line.
Ugh.
I lost my first tooth at 27.
Wow.
Now, I'm 42 now. And when I was 40, they basically told me all of my teeth have to come out because I was down to about 10 teeth that weren't broken off at the gum line. So I had to go in, and they had to put me under, and they had to basically dig what was left of my broken teeth out of my jawline. They just And all of my teeth were sheared off at the gum line. And the ones that weren't infected and destroyed, they were causing abscesses that were, I mean, making me so sick that I was sick all the time. I mean, I was losing weight. I was like a step before sepsis. So they went in, they put me on double doses of antibiotics to drop the abscesses, and they took what was left of my teeth out.
Oh, boy, that's rough. You can't imagine that. That's got to be tough to get through that.
Well, yeah, it was not fun. I mean, they took all of my teeth out in the same sitting.
Oh, man. Can't even imagine that. Oh. So, yeah, the teeth, the numbness, the migraines. And so all this goes on. You have all these side effects. So you reach out. You found some RF experts. Why don't you tell us about how you reached out to those guys and who you found?
Well, I initially started looking up information on the Internet about RF radiation and exposure and what happens, side effects, and I started finding more information showing that people that were exposed, studies that have been done, and I started getting, each time I did research, it was like any time that there was a research study done, it was these same names, and I started looking the names up. And I found that they were still in the business. The first one I contacted was Ed Manaply, who works for the FCC. And at the time, he was working for the EPA, and he was the ones doing the studies, I mean, in the beginning, back in the late 70s. And then he was printing all these studies out, and it was from the 70s to the 80s, it was always this guy's name coming up. And I got a hold of him. I tracked him down from the EPA to the FCC, and that's where he's still at. And he gave me more information than I could possibly imagine, and then put me in touch with other people like Richard Tell, who used to work for the EPA, and he now works for himself. Marvin Ziskin, he's actually an MD who studies RF radiation. And the exposure and what it does to the human body. And, I mean, I've been gathering intel for years now.
Now, there's one thing, before we go too deep into this, I think it was Marvin that wanted you to take a blood test, but it was just too far to drive. Is that Marvin?
Yeah. Well, Marvin Ziskin wanted me to drive to the, I think he works at a university.
Yeah, Temple.
And they wanted me to basically go through a battery of tests to find out exactly, you know, how bad off I am. But at the time, I mean, I was living in upstate. I couldn't work. I had already exhausted my savings through medical bills and basically trying to survive with no income. I mean, it was a really tough time because it, when you're sick, you think, well, if you're too sick to work, you should be able to get some help, but it didn't work out that way because you can't get any supplemental help from anywhere while you still have your life savings. So you have to exhaust your life savings before you can get anything like Medicaid.
So just to explain to everybody, if something bad happens and you get sick, it's more than just not working. It affects your whole life. I mean, you can't have kids. I mean, that's something that affects you. Lost his teeth. But not only that, but when you can't work, you're not making money. When you don't make money, obviously you don't have any benefits. You can't get the help you need. You just can't. It's tough, you know, especially if you have no one to turn to. So what you were trying to do is trying to get help, but it just seemed like everyone, you know, expected you to be able to drive for hours or pay for a room or whatever. I mean, you were weak. You were sick. You couldn't just up and leave. So I just want everyone to understand that.
When I got too sick to do anything, It was in 97. I had my stepbrother living with me because I couldn't even get out of my own bed.
Yeah.
Wow.
And by mid to late 97, I had already tried to deal with Medicaid and public service and trying to get any help that I could. And they just didn't want to hear it. And I ended up going back to work. I went back to climbing towers. I was sick of being so unhealthy that I couldn't do anything, but I was sick of feeling like a worthless piece of trash because you just sit around sick and not being able to do anything. And then you look at all the, you know, these welfare and all that, but if you don't jump through the right hoops or you don't know how to answer the right questions, you don't get any help. So I went back to work. I didn't care that I was sick. I cared that I couldn't put food in my fridge.
Yeah. I think people don't realize if you don't know how to work the system, you're screwed. I mean, they make it sound easy. Yeah, you go fill out some paperwork, but it's really not like that. So, wow. Well, okay, let's come back to Fred and Richard. How did they help you? I mean, what do you have to do to get those guys to help you out?
Well, actually, the first one I contacted was Ed Manapply.
I said Fred, Ed. Sorry, Ed.
Ed Manapply was more than willing to give me any information that I needed. I mean, he was in the system back in the 70s when people didn't even know about radiation. This guy was writing basically, you know, research studies and papers and all sorts of stuff that nobody else had been putting out there. And he was the one who started putting me in touch with people that would at least give me an idea of what was going on. You know, why was I so sick? You know, why can't I feel my hands? He put me in touch with the people that are still doing research. I mean, let's face it, you can't do a whole lot of research on what the radiation does to the human body because how many idiots are going to stand there and let you dose them? But he would at least have the information on people that have been overexposed and what did it do to them. I mean, if you've got 100 people that have been exposed over a 20-year period, and out of the 100 people, 99 of them have severe nerve damage, then you're gonna get an idea that they correlate together. I mean, the guys got burned up, and their nerves are dead. So it's a good feasible possibility that, you know, they got exposed and the radiation destroyed the nerves. And, you know, they can do case studies on overexposure and kind of put all the facts together and come out with, you know, a 50-50 that these health effects came from this exposure.
So Ed played a big part in pointing you in the right direction. And Richard, when did he come into play? When did he help you out?
Ed put me in touch with Richard about a year after I started talking to Ed.
Okay.
And Richard is, he basically, I was put in touch with Richard Tell because Richard Tell does a modeling of overexposure. He puts all the facts into figures about the type of antenna, how close you were to the antenna, the output of the transmitter. He puts that all into these calculations and then comes back with an approximate figure of what you were exposed to. That, I mean, that's his job is basically RF exposure for each incident. So he'll go through and put all the figures in, and then he'll come out with what was the person doing, you know, within a certain amount of distance of the antenna, and what could have he been hit with.
So Richard helped set up the scenario of what happened. You were up there 45 minutes and TV broadcast frequencies. I don't know what it was, but you were basically right on the antenna on the top of it and then climbed up and down the antenna. And that's when he's pretty sure that's when everything happened.
Yep.
Wow. So then what'd you do? I mean, were you able to get any? First thing people are going to ask, did you sue anybody? That's the first thing people are going to ask. So, didn't sue anybody? Did you think about it?
Oh, yeah, I thought about it. But unfortunately, you know, at the time, I didn't know what did all this. I mean, it wasn't until quite a few years later that I even knew anything that about the radiation. I mean, when I was hired on, all they were doing is hiring people who weren't afraid of heights. I mean, not that I'm stupid, but I get hired on because I'm afraid of heights. All I know is they're paying me a decent wage to go climb a tower.
Yep.
So I didn't know any of this. I didn't know about radiation. I didn't know about exposure and poisoning. I didn't know any of that. All I knew is I was getting migraine headaches, and, you know, I couldn't feel my hands. I thought I had arthritis. But by the time I could figure it out, it had been a long enough time. The statute of limitations in New York pretty much killed that.
Did you try to get a lawyer? Did you talk to a lawyer?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I called all the big name ones in the state of New York, and it went nowhere.
Okay.
I mean, everybody that I contacted was more than willing to go do a lawsuit, and they would talk about these high figures. I mean, just to deal with migraine headaches for the rest of my life and the fact that I can't have kids. I mean, you're talking six digits. These guys were foaming at the mouth to try and get this case. And then every single one of them, within a month, they would send me this formal letter of they're not interested.
You think it was because of who owned the TV station, or you just think it was a statute of limitations, or what do you think? What do you think it was?
I think it was because the TV station was owned by a conglomerate that is owned by Bain Investment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my opinion, but I can't prove that. But Bain Investment's got an awful lot of pull in an awful lot of places.
So you think it just scared people off?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was. So. Boy, I don't know. Man, no justice. I think a lot of people would look at that and say, well, back then people just didn't know any better. At that time, when you were talking to Ed, was Ed working for the EPA or the FCC?
The first time I talked to Ed Manaply, he was working for the EPA. And then when I started going through all the doctors, and they were putting me through all the testing and trying to find out how screwed up my health really is, that's when I tried to get a hold of Ed through the EPA so that I could get all the facts and figures from the TV station. And he had moved. And it took me a little bit to figure out where he had gone to, but he had moved from the EPA to the FCC.
Okay. So with Ed, you think Ed would have been behind you if you had a lawsuit? You think he would have supported you? I don't know if you ever talked to him about it, but...
He's not able.
Okay.
He can't just take a side. I mean, all he can do is be an informational source.
Okay, so he provides the info. What about Richard? Would he help you in any way, or do you think he wouldn't have been able either?
Him being a private consultant, he would have been able. I mean, basically, from what I had been told, if I'd have brought a civil suit, if I had been legally allowed to bring a civil suit against the TV station, it's not me having to prove that they basically cooked me like a turkey. It would be them having to disprove that they cooked me like a turkey. And that would have been harder.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find a lawyer that would take it. Just every lawyer I contacted they weren't even interested.
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Well, I can't take it myself. I mean, me trying to file a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against a TV station in New York by myself with no counsel, I'd look like an idiot.
Wow. So before we go on, what would be your message to all the climbers out there now, all the young guys? What would you say to them?
Well, I would say that just because you can't see something doesn't mean it can't hurt you. I mean, it's like gas. I mean, it's a silent, invisible killer. And if you screw up, I know when I was climbing, they didn't have all the badges that you wear and all that stuff now. But if you're on a tower and that thing starts flashing, get the hell off of the tower, because it doesn't take long to ruin your whole life.
So safety first. That's what we're trying to tell these guys, because now they have the tools to know. You know what I mean? I mean, we got the RF meters, we got the alerts. They can wear stuff. It's up to the companies to make sure their people are safe. We have full harnesses now. You know, we know that high power is going to hurt you, so we have to plan our climbs. So I'd like to think that, you know, all the climbers out there learn a lesson from this. You know, you're always going to have your guys that, I told you before, there's always guys out there that just think they know everything. I mean, just the way it is. But maybe if we can teach some of these younger guys to follow a procedure, they'll be in a lot better shape. So,
well, for me, if I would have had somebody tell me back when I was climbing that, hey, you know, you could be on that tower and if it's on, it's going to cook you. I might have second guessed the money that they were paying.
Yeah.
I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but had I known that my health would be shit from what they were paying me to do back then, I don't know if I would have been doing it. I mean, I know I was young and I was stupid. They were paying me, you know, decent money. I mean, I was making more than my dad. And, you know, when you're in your mid-20s and you're making more money than your father, who's been working his whole life, I mean, I wasn't a doctor, but I was making really, really good money.
Yeah.
But when I look at it, and then I look at what I deal with now and what I've had to deal with, you know, over the past almost 20 years, it's really not worth it. I mean, all the money that I made, I spent on freaking medical bills.
Yeah, that sucks. All that money. What do you think about 80 grand out there? You told me earlier.
I made almost 100 grand minus expenses in Alaska in 96.
Yeah.
And by the end of 97, I was broke.
Man, in 96, you made that much money.
Yeah.
A lot of money in 96.
But it's trying to survive without an income, and you can't just go get SSI because they're going to look at the, oh, you got 80,000 in the bank. You can't get SSI, and well, you sure to hell can't have Medicaid. And,
yeah.
You know, I just watched all that money just dwindle down to nothing.
Man.
And it's disheartening. I mean, I could have invested that money and you know, live like a human. But instead, I got to spend all that money on medical bills and trying to survive. And, you know, within a year and a half, all that money was gone. So all that money that I was saving, thinking I was the smart guy because I was doing all this work and, you know, they're paying me all that money. But, well, I look at it now. I mean, I struggle on a weekly basis doing what I can on the side because I can't work in an industry that pays 100 grand a year anymore.
Yeah, it's got to be tough. Now you have so many health problems. So many. It's really a disability, what it is.
Well, and yet you got to do something. I mean, I can't live on welfare. I'm not that type of a person. When I was really sick, and I couldn't do anything, I lived on welfare, but it didn't take me long to want to pull my freaking hair out. You just don't. And there's a lot of things that people don't understand about the welfare system. You get treated like some kind of a subhuman if you're disabled.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like if you're not paying income tax, then you're at the bottom of the, you know, the cesspool, and that's where you belong. I mean, and that's the way I felt. I mean, I would rather kill myself working and being in pain every day than to live within that realm of feeling like a degraded human.
Got a lot of pride, Bruce. A lot of pride. Which is
at one time, that's all I had.
Yeah, that's a good point. Got to live on that pride.
Yep.
So, now, you told me earlier about some guy went up there in an RF suit and worked at the same antenna at the same tower. Why don't you tell us what happened there?
From the story that he gave me, his suit started to smolder.
So he had an RF suit on. He was fully prepared, and the suit just started to smoke.
Yep.
Man.
Now I have been told that they have. I was in the industry way before they had all this safety crap. They actually didn't have the safety lines. I guess there's a safety line they bolt to the tower now. You clip to?
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have any of that when I was climbing. And they have a beeper or something that they wear that beeps if you're in a field.
For RF, yeah, the NARN alert, that beeps if there's too much RF. And you have to get them for different frequencies, like if you're in, there's some that scan everything, like from 1 hertz to, you know, a gigahertz roughly. And there's other ones that are especially for cellular. There's other ones for broadcast and things like that. But the whole idea, though, is, yeah, they beep when you get in a high RF field.
Well, this from what I was told, that now we're going back quite a few years because this guy stopped working for that company also. His suit started to smolder, and that beeper no longer functioned.
Oh, Friday alert.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're looking at enough current, enough RF to kill a piece of equipment that's supposed to tell you there's a field there?
Yeah. Can you imagine? You go up there and it just fries. I mean, that's just amazing.
Well, I've worked on some tower sites that we had a spectral analyzer?
Yeah.
We had one of those cook at ground level.
Yeah.
So it's not unheard of to be within a field that's I mean, extremely dangerous. And just because you can't see it don't mean it's not there.
Analyzer was on the ground, they just powered it up and it just fried the input, right?
Yep, gone. Cook
yeah,
it right out.
That.
So if you're cooking a piece of equipment that's supposed to be, you know, used to, you know, for detecting RF. I mean, it's for hooking to equipment for diagnosing RF. But you turn it on and it cooks at the ground level, and yet they want to send a dude up on a tower.
Yeah. And they don't. Now they do. I think I'd like to think people think twice now, but back then they didn't think twice. They're like, just get going. You'll be fine. That was their attitude, right? You'll be fine.
Yeah, you're okay. Just climb the tower. I mean,
yeah.
And when I play, I remember to the day that I climbed the tower and I was exposed. I mean, I remember all of it.
Wow.
The day like it was yesterday. I remember that day. And it was like any other day. But then there is times where I have a hard time remembering a year ago or two
wow.
years ago. But I remember the day I was exposed, and I remember stuff from before the day I was exposed that I don't remember stuff from that day till now. So I don't know what's happened. I just know that what I went through, and I've been told that there have been people climbing their whole life, and they've been around radiation their whole life, and they're fine.
Yeah.
At least to their knowledge, they're fine. And yet, I go up, and I do a job for 45 minutes, and that 45 minutes changes my life. So there are people who are more susceptible, or maybe there's people that they just, their bodies don't like the RF, and the drastic things happen, and then there's other people who are built like a brick shit house, and it just doesn't hurt them as bad. I don't know. All I know is that one day on 1 hour for 45 minutes destroyed my health to the where I longer.
Yeah, and that 45 minutes it changed everything. Your life is never the same. I think people need to understand how quickly things can change.
Well, the biggest thing that I mean, not to take all of my health things that I deal with now and put them to the wayside, like one's worse than the other, but I was in my mid-20s, and my ability to have kids is now gone. From that day forward, me being allowed to have a kid and watch kids grow up is gone, taken from me in 45 minutes.
Wow.
And anybody who's, I mean, you've got tower guys that are, you know, they get into the business, they want to get in and they want to climb, they want to make money. But if they ever want to have a family, then they have to look at what's going on. Because when you're exposed to an RF field, depending on the strength, it starts attacking your central nerves. It starts attacking your retinal nerves. It starts attacking your reproductive system. And those are the things that it attacks first. So if you ever want to have kids again, stay the fuck off at a tower if it's on.
Yeah, and
because if you don't, your ability to have kids is gone. I mean, you're taking a 50-50 gamble of becoming sterile in minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, people, that's the whole idea. That's what I try to write about. I'm just hoping people start to get smart at some point. I mean, you start taking it seriously. Which I think some do. I think a lot of guys do. I'm going to be honest with you. But you always have those few. You have people that are stupid or in a hurry.
Well, don't forget the ones who know too much.
Yeah, there's those guys that know everything. They're always right. Yeah. Yeah, it pays to slow down, think it through, and be smart.
I mean, don't get me wrong. There was times where I had great times on the tower sites. I mean, I've been on towers anywhere from 50, 60 feet tall to 1,280 feet tall. And the views, to me, the biggest thing was the view.
Yeah.
I mean, to be on top of a tower that was so tall that the vehicles on the ground looked like matchbox cars. I mean, to me, that was awesome. You were taller than anything else around you. You could see for ungodly distance. To me, it was great. I loved climbing. If you're gonna look at all these pluses, like look at all this money I'm making. I mean, I've got a new car. I'm 20 something years old, and I've got thousands of dollars. And I mean, if you're gonna look at all those good things and ignore the bad things that could or could not happen, you're gonna either screw up and suffer for the rest of your life. Or you're gonna get to that point, because I know at one stage I had gotten so comfortable with the heights that I didn't even think about clipping on.
Yeah.
I mean, tying off, I don't need to tie off because look how good I am up here. I can bounce from here to here and over there, and I don't need to clip on. And it takes one screw up, and you're gone. And people have to realize that you have to have respect for the things around you. Because if you don't, they will take you.
Yeah.
I mean, heights will kill you. Radiation will kill you. Everything within that field can kill you if you screw up.
Yeah. So I think two things. One, be smart. Don't be stupid when you're on the tower. And that's how I look at it. Don't be stupid. Because we all do dumb things. Just when you're on the tower, just think about what you're going to do. But I do agree with you. Like, when I climbed, you know, now I do business development, and I'm a solution architect. But when I climbed, I did love the job. I like being out in the field. I like the camaraderie, you know, because most teams get along. You always have a few guys you don't get along with. That happens. But for the most part, you're out with, let's say, two, three, or four guys, usually at least one guy with you. Most of the time, you get along pretty well. They're almost like family, you know, when you work together a long time. And like you said, dude, there's nothing like on a spring or a summer day being up on top of the tower. You see the view, even if you're only 200 or 300 foot up. What a view. I mean, it's just awesome. 500 or 600 feet up, that's really awesome. And I did enjoy it. I like working out at the tower site. I like being able to, you know, do our own job, call our own shots, being able to organize everything the way we wanted it, you know, the crew. We just knew at the end we had to get the dish up, get the antenna up, get the dish array up. We had to rig everything, and we wanted everyone to get home safe. I mean, that was the goal. Everyone go home safe, and no one got hurt. And you're always a guy that cut yourself. In fact, I don't know about you, but when we worked on the tower, you know, we said it wasn't a job until there was blood in the tower, because your hands always got cut up. It just did.
Yep.
Galvanization, bolts, sharp out.
Well, that was usually the cable straps.
Cable straps, yep. They always cut you. Freaking zip
ties. They were like razor blades with a nut and bolt through them. I mean, they were bad.
And everyone got cut on them. I mean, I'm not saying that every job, but, you know, you just, not that you're not paying attention. Most times you were paying attention, but you still got cut on them. It's like,
yep,
what I do.
Well, they're designed to be safe, but let's say you're putting up a 500-foot tower. I mean, how many cable straps are you actually putting together on your way down, you know, latching the cable in? I mean, hundreds.
Yeah.
You can't tell me that there isn't, out of 100 straps, there's not going to be one that's got a jagged edge that's going to grab you.
And I wore gloves all the time. I was a glove guy. A lot of guys just couldn't work in gloves, or they didn't like to work in gloves. Dude, I lived in gloves when I was on the tower. I never took my gloves, I hardly ever took my gloves off. Now and then, you know, you got to work with a screw or something, especially as the years went on, you know, you work with that, the microwave and the outdoor units. They always had small parts you had to screw with. So you had to take your gloves off so you didn't drop anything or whatever. But, for the most part, hey, I want you to tell some story here. You told me a story about that guy that was, you were working on those microwave dishes on the top of the tower. Was that up in Syracuse, and the guy stood in front of a microwave dish?
Yep.
What?
That was actually, that was on the Money Tower in Syracuse.
Yep.
And they were doing microwave paths. I can't remember from the Money Tower to where, but he ended up standing in front of another microwave dish, and it cooked him. And it cooked him really good, and he didn't survive. I don't think he lasted more than 4 months, and all of his internal organs shut down.
Wow. So did he get sick right away? Do you know what happened there?
He was actually taken from the building to the ER, and then he spent, I believe, the last four months of his life in ICU.
Oh my God! Can you imagine? That'd be awful.
He never left. That was the end.
And the reason I wanted to bring that up. Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
All radiation is dangerous, but the microwave's the worst.
Yeah. I want you to bring that up because when you're at a site, and I've been on sites where you walk right through the microwave field, they have dishes everywhere, you know, on the rooftop. You're walking on the rooftop, you know?
Yep.
And these guys, when they put these dishes up, a lot of times they do what's easiest to install, not what's best for the area or whatever. You know, they just say, oh, we can just put it here a few feet off the ground. We can turn it. Done. Meanwhile, the next guy that comes up is walking through that field, and it's a dish. So all the RF is concentrated, let's say it's a 6-foot dish, in that 6-foot area or 12-foot area, depends on how big the dish is. It's all concentrated going straight out that one area. Like a panel antenna, it could be 90, 180. But when you have a dish is meant to go point to point. It's concentrated in roughly that 3 degrees that it's shooting out. 3 degrees. All that RF is crammed into like a laser beam. That's what I just want people to understand, how crazy it is. When you're on a tower, just pay attention. I mean, when you're on a rooftop or on a tower. On the tower, the dishes are usually a little bit out away from the tower. You can go behind
them. Yeah, they're usually off a leg.
Yeah, they're off a leg, a standoff, whatever. But anyways, you're climbing behind the dish. But when you're at a rooftop, I mean, you're going to walk around the rooftop, right? So if you see a dish just pointing straight out, you know, I would walk in front of it. If you have to walk in front of it, I'd find out if it's live, what frequency it is, what power it's putting out, and usually mark that on the transmitter if you can get access. You know, either that or you can call the landlord. I know it's a pain in the ass to call the landlord, but it might be worth your time. But anyway.
Well, that was a big issue with the money tower, because the money tower, the top two penthouse floors were nothing but dishes. I mean, there must have been 100 freaking dishes over two floors, and they're all most of them are all owned by separate companies. I mean, if you got to go do an install, you don't know if the stuff's live, and if you're making money and you're under contract, you're not going to call 200 people.
I mean, I'm with you.
These guys, they want to rush in there and set up another, you know, put up another dish, mount everything, do the alignment, and go home and get paid. I mean, they're not thinking about, hey, that dish behind you, it's cooking you like a turkey.
Yeah, that's why we got to figure out a way to take our time. We got to be educated on what's at the site. I feel we do. I think the landlord's going to be held accountable at some point, or the manager, whoever manages the site. They're going to be held accountable at some point because they have to let people know. Now, if they send out what's out there on each dish and then the tower company, you know, the crews don't do anything about it, then, you know, what do? They've done all they can do. They've educated somebody at the company.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that what you're trying to instill for, you know, safety measures, and we're not talking about only RF safety. You have to talk about climbing safety, everything. You have to put everything out on the board so people to know.
Yeah.
Because you've got like OSHA, EPA, the FCC, the enforcement division. Most of the time when they get involved, it's already too late. Somebody has either died or been cooked or, you know, ruined their whole life or fallen and broken their legs. You only see them come on site when either somebody complains or somebody is hurt or dead.
Yeah.
And you have to instill the safety measures before it comes to that point. I mean, how many people got to fall off a tower and die before people start thinking, hey, maybe we should start worrying about safety before this guy drops and makes his 25-year-old wife a widow?
And that's what I try to say. Safety really should be looked at end-to-end. But right now, and when I say end-to-end, I'm talking to tower owner or site manager, whatever it is, all the way to the climber and everything in between. Education's the key. So the reason I say that is because, let's face it, and I guarantee you, back in the day you climbed, you probably climbed a lot of towers that you didn't want to climb. You just knew they weren't safe. Probably made you wake up a little bit and be a lot more careful. Because I climbed a lot of towers that were just, you know, crazy dangerous. But, you know, you paid attention to what you're doing. You're just really aware of what was going on that day because you knew the tower was a health hazard. So,
now, I've been on a couple of towers that when I look back, I mean, I was on a couple of towers in windstorms that, I mean, you're talking 3 feet of movement from side to side with the wind.
Yeah, I've done that too.
I mean, these guys, they want you to put a, I can't remember which DB it was, but it was basically a single, you know, mast antenna. And I remember trying to bolt one of these into place with this tower moving 3 feet side to side.
Wow.
And you finally call down on the radio and you're like, you know, I don't give it, I really don't care. I'm not going to try and put this antenna in place with this wind. I mean, I can barely keep myself on the tower, let alone hold this antenna while I bolt it in. I mean, I've seen antennas come down. I mean, I've seen people drop an antenna that's 8 or 9 feet long from 100 feet, and they'll go through anything. They'll go through a truck. They'll go through the building underneath you. I mean, Lord knows if they were to hit somebody, they'd be done.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in that era, they were more worried about money than they were about safety.
It's true. I mean, that's a lot of people just worried about getting the job done so they could get paid. I think it's that way today. I think that's why we had so many problems here just a few years ago. People are more worried about the schedule than they are about the people. So So.
You know, I have friends that are still in the industry, and I've been told that they're still hiring kids right out of high school.
Yeah.
And they're paying them. I mean, for me, if they're paying somebody $12 or $15 an hour to climb 200, 300, 400 feet in the air, then they're not putting a whole bunch on the value of somebody's life.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what you're making. I mean, you know what these companies are paying you. Now, I don't know why they're only doing $12 and $15 an hour for somebody to go risk their life every day. But if that's the case, how is it they were able to pay us that much more when I was climbing? And we're going back 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. Good question. I don't know, because climbing has become devalued, I guess, because people don't look at it as a skill. But let's face it, it is. It's a skill. Good climbers know what you're doing, you know.
Well, if they don't consider it a skill, then let their ass go up 500 feet and you know, strap into a tower and try and I'm not sure if they still use the same type of antennas, but I don't think anything has changed to the point that they've had to change to a smaller antenna. So let them go try and put an antenna in that weighs 50 pounds.
I'm with you. Fly it through the air, put it in, guide it in, and handle the hardware all at the same time. The tools, the hardware.
Yep. And don't drop any hardware, because from 300 or 400 feet, you'll kill somebody. So, when I was climbing, I mean, you strap yourself in, and we didn't even have harnesses. We were making harnesses out of double lanyards and stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, let them go up there and you know, clip themselves in with a couple of lanyards and a D-ring, and then screw with stuff without dropping anything, and let them do it in February, which is when I was doing it and I got exposed. I mean, let them freeze their ass off while they climb up there, and then go sit, you know, and wait for this to be brought up to you with a pulley. And I mean, if you want to devalue it, put yourself in their shoes for a little while.
Yeah, I'm with you, buddy. I know what you're saying. So I'll tell you what, we've been on the phone over an hour. I'm going to let you go, Bruce. Thanks. Appreciate you being on the podcast. I do. I really do. And I want to get you on again, because you have some great stories, and I want to talk about the gin pole that folded, but that'll be future. I think this one's long enough.
The way I figure is if my story can at least touch one person, and one person doesn't have to deal with what I went through, then at least I've helped somebody not have to suffer like I have.
So would that be your message to the young climbers out there? That would be it. Learn.
Yeah, it would. I mean, if you can learn something from my mistake, I mean, not that I knew I was making a mistake, but at the time I wasn't worried about safety either. I wasn't worried about anything other than that paycheck.
Yeah.
But if somebody can actually let my story sink in and save themselves from whether it's the sterility or the nerve damage or the migraines or any of that, then I've reached out and helped at least one person. And to me, it's worth it. I mean, I've already suffered. I mean, I know that my life has been changed for my life. I mean, it ain't going to go away. It's not going to get any better. I mean, hopefully it doesn't get any worse. But if I can stop one person from suffering for the next 20 years, then it's worth it to get it out there.
Thanks, Bruce.
Yep.
I appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate you sharing your message. And I put the blog out about it, which I hope you saw. And I appreciate you doing that, too. That was a big help. So I want to get this show out. It takes me a little while. So it won't go out tomorrow. Sorry, buddy, but I'll give it out soon.
Well, you're gonna have to edit out all the. You're gonna have to edit out all the cursing anyway.
Yeah, I know. I've edited out the cursing, and I have to go through it. Plus, it's an hour long. Well, I got an hour 16. So, but I appreciate it, Bruce.
Well, it'll only be 45 minutes once you edit out all the cursing.
Yeah, good point. And just so everyone knows, I know we were pretty serious on this one, but. Bruce has some great stories, which I'm sure, you know, I can get a lot of climbers on here that do. And I want to bring up one more thing. Bruce had some bad luck out there. I'm not going to lie, you know, and something stupid, 45 minutes, and basically his career was over less than a year later. But there's a lot of climbers out there. Like, I know guys that have done it 20, 30 years because they're smart. They're good climbers. They know what they're doing. And they were lucky because back when stuff like this happened to Bruce, they just happened. They were lucky enough that it didn't happen to them. And I think most of them will tell you. That's the one thing most climbers that have been in it for, say, 15, 20 years, they say, I've been lucky because they didn't have to deal with it. And also because chances are, like next time we'll talk to Bruce about all the accidents he's seen. And I know I've seen a few. Now, I was lucky. Most of my crews, I never let anyone get seriously hurt. I mean, guys got cut. I had one guy that cut his leg, you know, because he did something stupid. You know, he was cutting tape, knife went down and went right in his leg, all to the hospital. I don't know if it was 6 or 8 stitches. But I was lucky because I never had a fatality. I never had anyone get seriously hurt. And then after I left that company, one guy did break his leg, and it was just a dumb freak accident. Had nothing to do with it. I think it was a little careless, looking back. But at the time, you know, it was they were trying to haul up a big toolbox. Well, I think it was a parts box up the tower. And when they were bringing it up, they didn't pull it straight up, but they thought they had it. Of course, a guy slipped. Another guy, that box guy, slammed the guy's leg between, what did he hit? I think he hit the footer of the tower, and it just snapped his leg, just like a twig. But I'll tell that another time. Can you imagine, Bruce? I mean, can you imagine? When that sucks, you're hours from anywhere, and you got to sit there and deal with it.
Yep.
Even you, man, you had all those problems. I can't even imagine that. I feel lucky I made it as far as I did. Anyway, I'm going off here. So, Bruce, thanks. Appreciate your time. I'll probably get in touch with you tomorrow. And everyone else, thanks for listening. And just remember, you know, be smart. Don't be stupid. And Bruce, any last words?
No, just learn. Take the information and hopefully sink it down somewhere and keep it.
All right. Thanks, buddy. All right, Bruce. I'll let you go. See you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.